From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM later on tonight. Oh, yes, those Friday night into Saturday morning, open lines, anything goes. Here's what's happening. A Russian fighter jet conducted a barrel roll over the top of a U.S. Air Force jet, which was flying a reconnaissance mission in international airspace above the Baltic Sea. The Russian Su-27 approached alongside within 25 feet, that's pretty darn close, folks, of the U.S. aircraft, and then flew inverted over the top of the plane to the other side. This is a provocation of something very dangerous. They're provoking the possibility of a collision in midair, and then who knows what will happen after that. The Chinese government has denied a Navy flotilla access to the port in Hong Kong, according to Pentagon officials. It's the latest sign of escalating tension between the United States and China there. Thousands of New Yorkers are being discreetly informed by detectives that their names have appeared on a list of potential targets, possibly compiled by terrorists. New York police officials are confirming the existence of the list of more than 3,000 names. Donald Trump brushing aside yet another protest Friday, even joking that it was kind of fun. He had to jump over a fence, as a matter of fact, to get to his venue. He told a gathering of California Republicans that he's winning landslides on the road to what he described as a record-setting performance in the GOP primaries. Trump addressed the California GOP convention as part of a very visible push to win what could be a decisive primary in the state in June. Dr. John Curtis, of course, with us, one heck of a guy who has been watching the campaign for months now. He keeps Trump keeps rolling along, John.
He does, George, and you know he's knocking at the door right now to the nomination, and the not so covert conspiracy to the anti-Trump movement led by Jeb Bush and John McCain and, you know, Mitt Romney and others. They are making their last-ditch push right now in Indiana. The governor of Indiana just endorsed him. But those riots that are, you know, going on and people jumping on cars and stuff is very carefully orchestrated by the Clinton and the Sanders campaign because they don't want to run against Trump. Remember that the new polling that is coming out right now shows that Trump runs very competitively against Hillary Clinton. She's extremely fearful, the Democratic Party is, of his appeal to independents and disgruntled, I mean, really frustrated Democrats who see the government basically in a complete shutdown, dysfunction, and it has been for years. And they're thinking, well, 4 years with Hillary Clinton, gee, that sounds like it would be another 4 years of gridlock. So these riots that are going on are trying to send a message, very carefully orchestrated, that Trump is a racist, Trump is a misogynist, and we have to oppose him at any course. But they're completely staged and carefully orchestrated.
Now, we know the Cleveland authorities are getting prepared when the Republican convention starts there. What do you think of the problems that we could face in Cleveland?
Well, I've been saying this for quite a long time, that I think it's premature to say that this is going to a brokered convention yet. Trump is at about...
I've said that. I want everybody to know I have said that.
Yeah, and I think that Trump is knocking at the door right now. He's only 230, I think it's six delegates away right now, and he's way up in California. He will win, whether he wins Indiana or doesn't win any, it's proportional voting, and you can expect him to pick up probably 50% of the delegates. So he's well on his way right now, and entering any kind of convention in July, there is not going to be another option for the Republican Party other than Trump. There's nobody that's going to come out of the woodwork. Paul Ryan has categorically said, and by the way, Paul Ryan is not a great candidate for a national election because he's one of the most conservative members he's more conservative in many ways than Ted Cruz is.
Hey, by the way, you're not broadcasting in the middle of the street, are you? Somebody just honked at you.
Did they?
Yeah. Be careful.
Like I say, they're agreeing with
Can Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton?
He 100%.
You think so?
Hillary Clinton. He has a growing body of independents and crossover, what they call the Reagan Democrats, that are itching for a change in Washington and do not want to see 4 more years of gridlock.
John, you're generally somewhat liberal, so I find this to be fascinating that and I'm not saying you're pro-Trump, but you are pro what he's doing.
Well, I'm basically just trying to report the facts as I analyze them. You know, George, that I've been writing politically neutral commentary for years. I write about 30 columns a month.
I just know the real John Curtis. That's all.
Yeah, but well, I mean, what we're looking at right now is a real phenomenon of people rising up, and I don't think Bernie Sanders, you know, even though he's not making it on the Democratic side, that movement of people that are just fed up with the gridlock, fed up of the partisan bickering, want something new in 2016. And I think that the Clinton campaign, the DNC, are very, very worried about a Trump candidacy.
All right, John, thank you. Have a good weekend. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. A man infected with the Zika virus in Puerto Rico has died from complications of the infection. The man in his 70s died from internal bleeding caused by this very rare immune reaction to the virus, according to the CDC. It's the first death in the United States from Zika virus, Puerto Rico, of course, being a U.S. territory. A former postal worker has pleaded guilty. Why would a guy like this do that? He knew he'd get caught. Pleaded guilty to stealing income tax refund checks worth more than $400,000 from people along his New Jersey mail route. The U.S. attorney out there says that Earl Champagne has pleaded guilty to theft of U.S. mail and theft of government money. Prosecutors say he admitted stealing 72 U.S. Department of Treasury checks totaling $443,000 and giving them to other people who weren't named in court documents. Fishman says those people were paid and that they also gave Champagne, this is the guy, Earl Champagne, $50 per stolen check in 2014. Amazing how these identity thieves do this and thefts. I mean, how do these people cash these checks? Made out to other people. Doesn't make any sense. Mail carriers in Britain, by the way, don't have to worry about a dog when they deliver to one Bristol home, but they identified a jumpy cat named Bella as a potential hazard. Matthew Sampson, the cat's owner, says that he has sent a letter to the post office out there, they call it the Royal Mail, saying that the cat is a threat to the staff. This is his letter. He said, "Your postmen have reported that when they push the mail through the letterbox, your cat snatches the mail and puts his fingers at risk." I guess the cat goes ballistic and scratches away at the fingers. The cat loves it. And Sampson says that the cat thinks it's a game, but this cat gets really vicious there. More than 1,300 pounds of bronze Roman coins dating back to the 3rd century A.D. have been unearthed by construction workers digging a trench in Spain. Boy, that ought to be worth something. And what else is going on in the stars? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you got?
Good evening, George. Lots going on, as is the case every week, but I'm going to try to keep it in time this week. I'm just have a short, brief report with 3 short sighting reports, but with your permission, I'd like to kick it off tonight with just a brief administrative comment.
Permission granted.
With regard to prank calls, I've mentioned this issue before to give our listeners some idea of how large, what the magnitude of this problem is. Since 4 o'clock this afternoon, I've taken 45 prank calls over the national UFO.
Same people, you think?
Hotline. Same people in a few cases, but different people all the time are placing prank calls. This started really in earnest in early March. I've taken between 1,000 and 1,500 prank calls in the last 7 weeks.
And what do they say? What if you could see it on the air?
Oftentimes, they don't say anything. Many times, if they speak, it's obscene, it's quadruple X rated. And the reason I mention this, you are a champion of worthy and important calls, or causes, not calls, causes. Malaysian Flight 370, of course, protecting the grid, Lyme disease, building number 7, and so on. I would like to respectfully suggest that you might consider taking up the cause that has parents and grandparents supervising their kids' use of cell phones. It's a real, real problem from my vantage point. I mention it, too, for the benefit of the Coast listeners, because I may have to switch the operation to just using an answering service, the way MUFON does in many states, probably for good reason. But
yes,
I mention it. It is a serious problem, and we may have to close down the UFO hotline. I'm just sick to death with young American kids.
Can we set up some kind of caller ID system?
Well, I have caller ID. I have their numbers. It's a question of whether they're using real numbers or somebody else's telephone. You have to be very careful about that.
Right.
You don't want to hammer somebody who's not a guilty
person. All right, let's talk more about that, Peter, off air. That sounds like something we might be able to help you with.
Boy, I can use all the help I can
get. Okay, my friend. Go ahead.
Three brief reports, if I've got a minute more, George. Monday of this week, Mukilteo, Washington, just north of Seattle, very close to where the Boeing 747 is constructed. Three people, parents and their grown son, were having dinner together. They saw a shiny metallic disc come right out of Payne Field, which is adjacent to that Boeing 747 plant. For people who'd like to read that report, very well written, very nice report. We link to it from our homepage. 2 days later, South Kingstown, Rhode Island, not Kingston, Kingstown, down on the western shore of Narragansett Bay, I guess it is, a federal employee was driving to the south on Route 1. This one you'll like, George. It was a golden star hovering above some high-tension wires, and it was spinning like a whirling dervish. And the guy was so intrigued, he drove down a mile, turned around, came back, and the object was gone. But as if nuclear explosions and coronal mass ejections are not sufficient risk for our grid, UFOs are adding to that list. I'll leave it at that to keep it short tonight. Appreciate your hearing me out.
Oh, always.
Call.
We're here to help you, Peter. And also, you're going to McMinnville, Oregon pretty soon for a great UFO event.
2 weekends from now, I'll be speaking at McMinnville. Invite any Coast listener to come up and introduce himself or herself to me. I always like talking to the Coast audience.
Okay, thanks very much. It's Peter Davenport. Folks, don't prank the National UFO Hotline. Come on. You've got better things to do. He thinks they're kids. Be careful. Okay, we're going to come back in a moment with Joe Nickel. We're going to talk about some things a skeptic's take on ghosts next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me introduce, he's back, Joe Nickel, widely regarded as one of the world's most professional paranormal investigators. Now, he's a former stage magician, private investigator for a world-famous detective agency, and among other personas, Joe has interrupted the life of adventure, returning to the University of Kentucky for a master's and doctorate in English literature, with an emphasis on literary investigation and folklore. He's also a senior investigator for the Skeptical Inquirer Science magazine. We just had Michael Shermer on just a few months ago. Joe, welcome back, too. How are you?
Hey, George. Good to hear from you.
You know, when people hear the word skeptic, they think that means non-believer. Not the case, is it?
Well, you know, we're not, science is not in the belief business, of course. What we're in is the investigation business, really, and I decry the term debunker, as you know. It sounds like you're the flip side of the true believer, that we start with the answer and then work backward to the facts, whereas, of course, detectives try to do the opposite. Look for clues, look for evidence, sort out the best evidence, and let that lead to a conclusion. So when people say they're a debunker, they're sort of saying, I don't care what you tell me, I'm not going to believe it, I'm going to put it down. And what I'm trying to do with my work with ghosts, whether it's ghosts or Bigfoot or what have you, is to actually go and actually investigate, try to find out what's going on, and then provide the simplest and best scientific explanation for it. And so I like the term investigator. I think that's a respectable term, but I'm a little chagrined with that term being used by ghost hunters calling themselves paranormal investigators, and they're almost exactly the opposite of investigators, George.
And Joe, you've got a varied background. How did you get involved in this?
Well, you know, when I was 8 years old, I knew I was a detective, and my parents humored me by setting aside a room in the house that could become my crime lab. Of course, I grew up and went through the turbulent 60s and discovered girls and a lot of things. But I never lost sight of the detective idea and ended up working as a stage magician at the Houdini Hall of Fame. My father had been an amateur magician, so that was a natural for me. Became a stage magician at the and resident magician at the Houdini Hall of Fame. And from that, got interested in the paranormal, got, you know, brushed up on Houdini's involvement in it, a great long involvement, met the amazing Randy, who was a skeptic doing something like what Houdini did, and eventually went on to become a private investigator to get skills to actually investigate. And somehow, somewhere along the line, I put those two together to become what someone called me, a magic detective. To try to use the techniques of investigation, and of course that it would include forensic science and what have you, even of course scholarship, folklore, really all kinds of things could be brought into a particular case, but using that to try to solve a mystery that seems in some way magical, that's intriguing, strange, you know, the kind of stuff that intrigues you and me both.
Have you come across at this point, Joe, in your career, some episode, some event that you would say, you know what, I just can't prove this to be false. I don't know what it is, but I can't rule it out.
Well, you raise a very good point. The problem is that we have to look at the burden of proof in some of these cases. People will call me up and say, "Oh, I saw a bright light in the sky and yada yada, and what was that?" And I'll say, "I don't know." And they'll say, "See?" As if something has been proved by "I don't know." And the problem is the whole paranormal, George, this is a sweeping statement I'm going to make, but and feel free to challenge me, but the whole paranormal is pretty much based on what's called an argument from ignorance in logic. It doesn't mean the person's ignorant. It just means, you know, I don't know. So it goes like this. I don't know what the bright light in the sky was, so it must be a flying saucer from another planet. Or we don't know what the noise in the old house was, so it must be a ghost. Or we don't know why Mrs. Smith's cancer went into remission. It must be a miracle of the Holy Virgin Mary, and so on. And almost all of the paranormal is that way. It's really negative evidence. We don't know what it was, blurry photo or strange occurrence, some noise, some light, and we're trying to draw a conclusion from it. And the fact that someone else can't explain it means very little, because it may be that there's not enough evidence of anything to explain. You know, I often tell UFO people, and I respect that they've seen something, but I don't know what you saw, and I don't know, or even I don't know what you think you saw.
All right, stay with us, Joe. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more. We'll take phone calls next hour. Joe Nickel, our special guest. By the way, he's an author, too. A couple books out there called The Science of Ghosts and Adventures in Paranormal Investigation. He takes this seriously, and I appreciate that. We're going to come back in a moment with Joe Nicholas. We continue our Friday night into Saturday morning show on Coast to Coast AM. Well, what a night. It's that Friday night and the Saturday morning night, so we're going to have some open lines later on in the program. And next hour, we'll open up the phone lines and talk with Joe Nickel about his works, The Science of Ghosts and Adventures in Paranormal Investigation. And welcome back to Coast, Joe Nickel with us. Joe, when you investigate these paranormal cases, first of all, how do they come to you? How do you find out about them?
Well, I usually look, George, for cases that are already sort of in the news that has gotten a lot of attention,
okay,
and that cries out for somebody to do something. Because I find if I take calls from people wanting to, you know, call in their report, I get crazies. I get people looking for attention. You don't know what you're getting, and I'm not able to just fly around the country and visit every one of the 20,000
you'd go broke.
Places. But something like to give an example, the Atlanta House of Blood, which was a sort of strange poltergeist case, and people suggested maybe it was getting out of hand and I should look into it. And I arranged to go to Atlanta. I was able to get the Atlanta Homicide Task Force to meet with me, the commander, and allow me to look at the crime scene photographs. And here were these, you know, traces of blood, trickles and spatters and so forth of blood throughout this elderly couple's house. I was able to get, through Freedom of Information Act, I was able to get copies of these crime scene photos. And I knew enough about blood pattern analysis to know it would play a big role here, because the elderly folks were saying that the blood was springing up from the floor and oozing out of the walls. And I knew enough to know that that didn't look right. But I don't play it being a kind of scientist I'm not. So I got a nationally known blood pattern analyst, Judith Bunker, and she was able to do a detailed study and to show that this blood was squirted onto, flung onto the floor and walls, giving the lie to the couple's story. And the police had already privately concluded that they were looking for attention. So that's kind of an example of what I try to do, and that is look at the evidence that's there, not go in with some kind of ghost hunting equipment or something that has no scientific validity, but to actually say, what's going on here? What's the evidence? Let's get it. Now let's have it properly examined. And that's in a capsule sort of what I'm trying to do with most of my cases.
Do you enjoy doing this? Sounds like you do.
I do. I never, you know, my debunker friends who, you know, they think, oh, woe is me, another silly story. Why do we have to? And I think, you know, lighten up. These cases are interesting. People are naturally drawn to reports of lake monsters, particularly if they've seen a lake monster. And I've talked to so many people who have, or they've seen Bigfoot. And I'm with them. There's something that needs to be explained.
Something's happening here.
Yeah, something's happening. And my earliest being was that I was a curious kid, and I've never gotten over that, and I hope that I never do, because I think curiosity is a very good thing. It's a sign of intellect and a sign of caring and a sign of, you know, being interested in the world. So I'm happy to keep doing this, and I find enough different cases that are, you know, you'll see a bunch that are very, very similar, and you'll think, oh, no, not another, you know, not another one of those. But then you find something that's really, really strange, and that keeps me going.
All right, let's talk a little bit about ghosts, Joe. What do you think is happening? I'm sure by now you've come to some conclusions on what this phenomenon is.
Well, I used to resist trying to talk broadly about topics because I was so focused on case by case, and I insisted we always should just look at a particular case. But after 40 years of doing this, I guess I should have some opinion. I think that it's very unlikely, George, much as I would like it to be so. You know, I remember when my grandmother died and how much I wanted that not to be the case. And we all would, I think if we were voting, we would like to believe that ghosts were real, because then we don't really die. And I would like to believe that. But the idea that somehow you have a life energy that at death just gets up out of your body and can walk and talk and so forth without the physical brain and without dissipating.
It's amazing.
You know, if you turn off a light bulb, where does the light go? Does it go to light bulb heaven, or does it, the energy just dissipates once the source is cut off? And the idea that this energy can retain even a human shape, you know, people have ghost photographs with approximately 99% of these are faked, but they show people looking very much like ordinary people, only sort of transparent, looking rather like double exposures. And the idea that this energy could keep the shape of a human being, and then the idea that your clothing, which would be inanimate, it would not be a life energy, would that we would see people dressed in their Civil War soldiers uniforms and carrying a musket. These are not plausible concepts from a scientific standpoint. And the ghosts that people see, and I don't question that people have apparitional experiences. Absolutely, they do. But I don't question that, but that they are very much the same as dreams. That is, they are just what you can picture in your mind. So that's kind of a bottom line. And then, well, what's happening with the ghost hunter types who are going into haunted houses looking to photograph orbs or using their electromagnetic field meters, and they're just engaging, and I'm sorry to say this, engaging in pseudoscience, because there's just nothing that they're doing that's scientific in any way. The orbs we now know are almost totally particles of dust close to the camera that are bouncing the flashback, and I've made many of these orb pictures, like at Alcatraz or some famous haunted site. Mm-hmm. I'll go and do a demonstration and show I can make orbs on demand. Or the electromagnetic field meters, which pick up any kind of electromagnetic field, so they could be a microwave broadcast tower, they could be, you know, their own electronic equipment. I think that a lot of ghost hunters are mostly detecting themselves.
Yeah, well, in some cases, I think that there are some kinds of glare and things like that in these photographs.
Yes, and the problem with a photograph, and I've seen so many, you know, whether they're UFO photographs or Bigfoot photographs or ghost photographs, a photograph is not evidence of very much. I mean, a forensic photograph is, because it's made under known conditions by an expert and is, you know, becomes a part of real evidence. But you don't know, when someone shows you a snapshot, you don't know what's really going on with it. And there might be a strange glare or something like that in the upper right corner of the photo. You don't know that there's not something reflective just out of the view of the camera. And unless you could go to that site and personally investigate that and recreate maybe a set of circumstances that will never be the same again, a particular fluke. Somebody happened to have something shiny that walked by and it reflected the light. So it's just, it's wonderful that people have so-called evidence. There is a huge amount of evidence for the paranormal, but it's really mostly pretty bad evidence.
When you hear stories of UFOs and visitations and alien abductions, do you put that into this category as well?
I do. I mean, people see things. People see UFOs. I've seen UFOs. Mine eventually became IFOs, that identified flying
sure.
objects. I know Peter Davenport, and we've talked and worked on things that are along similar lines, but People do, just like they have ghost experiences or Bigfoot experiences, yes, there are UFO experiences. They're not all hoaxes. They're not all seeing weather balloons. But you have to look at each case and see what's really there. And the alien abduction phenomenon, which is one of the most, you asked earlier if I'd seen something that really gave me pause or that really seemed wow. And I remember my reaction when I first started hearing about people having these alien abduction experiences, and I didn't know what to make of it. It sounded to me, wow, if these are hoaxers, this in itself is so widespread, it just takes your breath away. But we now know pretty well that like John Mack's alien abduction cases, I took his 13 cases in his book and looked at them. And these people, to make a long story short, if you go through and look for personality markers in their accounts, mm-hmm. in a chapter on each of these people, quite a lot of information, you find that they're all easily hypnotized, they're had rich imaginative lives, they maybe had imaginary playmates or something like that. These people are what are called fantasy-prone personalities. And when you take someone like that and hypnotize them, and let me define hypnosis, it's the yellow brick road to fantasy land. And this is, I've talked to Whitley Strieber, people that have been hypnotized then start telling you what sounds like a fantasy is probably just that.
So in this vast universe, though, you have got to come to the conclusion that we cannot be alone.
Well, yes, the honest thing, because I have a friend who's a little on one side and I'm a little the other as to how likely it is, but my goodness, in the infinity of the universe, who would proclaim to know that there is nothing there? On the other hand, we don't really know that there is something there, and the honest person has to say, okay, I don't know. But there certainly seems to be lots of chances. My friends at SETI, the search for...
Sure. So do you know Seth Shostak?
I know Seth very, very
good
well.
Guy.
And yes. And Jill Tarter, who the Jodie Foster played her on, mm-hmm. In the movie Contact.
That's right.
I know them very well. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was at a big conference in Montreal with Jill. These are friends of mine, and I say, yes, absolutely, let's search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We just don't know. It looks like, from a certain point of view, that the planet Earth is a pretty unique place, that a series of pretty incredible coincidences and accidents had to happen to get us where we are. If there is alien life elsewhere, then... That also may be a long shot, but as you point out, there's so many opportunities, so many planets around so many suns that there's a lot of chances to play that odd.
Well,
where I'm skeptical is whether anything is coming to visit us now. I don't think there's evidence for that. But
let's make this assumption, though. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. Good investigation doesn't just assume. You need some proof. But if this vast universe has the complexity, as Shostak would say, of hundreds of millions, if not billions, of Earth-like planets out there, I mean, they're still finding galaxies with billions of star systems out there. So let's just make a mathematical assumption, because that's what the Drake equation was, which helped start SETI.
Right. I've got a friend who's revised the Drake equation.
Well, even if it's revised down.
But I'm with you.
Yeah,
I see what you're saying.
That there's got to be an astronomical amount of possible Earths, and then, if life, which we still don't understand, started here, whether it came in on a comet or an asteroid or who knows how it got here. And I'm taking the religious aspect out of it for a moment, though I'm going to get into that with you in a second, that it had to have started in other areas. I will agree with you that all of this, in terms of complexity, is very strange and probably very rare, but there's so many of them out there.
Yep,
you're gonna get that possibility.
I think you can certainly make that case. The problem is, though, that the farther away you get from us, the less likely it is that they've been able to travel those long distances.
Well, thinking that they travel, if they travel the way we travel, you're absolutely right. But let's assume a civilization that's a million years ahead of us, and they have
But even if they traveled at the speed of light, which is apparently scientifically impossible, even if they could do that, I mean, when we're talking about places that are hundreds of light years away,
well,
just not practical that they're coming here and buzzing the planet Earth.
Let's assume one thing, that what they have come across is something in the universe that has the ability to bend space and time. So that if you just imagine a piece of paper for a moment and put a dot on each end, to get from one dot to the other, let's say that's the universe, would take you until the end of time. It's impossible. But bend those two dots over so they meet each other instantly, you're there. And let's assume for a moment, I'm getting really deep here.
This is a lot of assumptions.
It sure is. But that there is some kind of force out there in the universe, if you can find it, whether it's a wormhole or something, that allows you to travel by going through these pockets that get you from point A to B in an instant. Maybe, if you're
up there. You know, I'm all for, I mean, what you're doing is a sort of science fiction.
It's a good movie.
Kind of, it certainly is. And
we'll call it Contact.
would be interesting. But I'm a practical guy, and I'm looking at what are real cases, and do those real cases suggest any such thing? I remember when a guy phoned me from Phoenix, from radio station one morning, and he said, we've got this phenomenon here, these bright lights, and Phoenix lights.
97, right? 1997.
What is this, he said. And I said, I have no idea. And he said, of course, see, using the argument from ignorance. And I said, no, wait, I don't know what it is, but I'll bet we soon know. And I said, let me suggest this, that whatever it is, the least likely explanation at the bottom of your list is that it's extraterrestrial craft. And he said, why do you say that? And I said, well, because all the other explanations are simpler, and we have evidence for them. And also, I said, and I was getting towards a punchline. I said, why on earth would aliens be coming to the planet Earth and seek on a secret mission and then hover over Phoenix with their bright lights on? And I got a laugh with that. But we now, I think we know that the Phoenix lights was this, National Guard.
Well, I don't know. A lot of people have refuted that, Joseph.
Formation was the first set of lights, and the second, pretty well proven parachute flare drop. It was a training exercise. So there's just a lot of corroborative evidence and factual evidence on that, and you have to get into conspiracy theories and plots and so forth to think somebody's faked all this. So that's the way I think, and it's made me an international whipping boy.
No, it sure has. So life after death, the ability to have that ghostly realm, does it exist, yes or no?
Is there a ghostly realm?
Mm-hmm.
I think not. I've come to believe increasingly that we live in a real and a natural world, and that
when you die, that's it.
That's it. And I'm as sorry about that, George.
That's your opinion.
I can't convey to you.
Hey, Joe, we're at the top of the hour. We're coming back for more. I'm going to ask you the $64,000 question when we come back. Plus, we'll take calls.